Welcome to Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show. So Kaushik, how's everything going?
Going good. How is the new year been for you, Don?
It's been good. You know, just trying to keep up with all the things going and keep all the plates spinning. So it's been well. How did it go for you?
Yeah, new year's been good. 2016 is a new year, a different year. I'm sure it's going to be an amazing year for everyone.
Correct. So what are we going to talk about today?
Done.
What?
Let me explain you what we're going to talk about today. We have with us our good friend and Android developer extraordinaire, Israel Federer. Welcome to the show, Israel.
Hey. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for inviting me on this podcast, amazing podcast. And let me explain you some things about Android, by the way.
So, Israel, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your work with Android and maybe some of the companies that you've worked for.
Cool. Yeah, so I'm originally from Spain, and I was working as an Android developer there. My first, actually, professional Android job was in my own company. We started a company called boobyloop.com, which was trying to recommend Android apps for people. At that time, in 2009, the market was the Play Store at that time, Android market wasn't that good. Mm-hmm. So we thought it was a good idea. We failed, though. So here I am. thanks to that, I met many people from the Valley, from Silicon Valley. And that opened the door for me to came here. And my first job here in Silicon Valley was with Lookout. It's a security company. And they have an Android product that I was working on for a year and 6 months. And after that, I joined Twitter in the Fabric team. Well, that was a super interesting role, you know, SDK development, which is different from app development.
This is like a question I've always been super intrigued. When you when your product is like an API, right? Is that very different from actually developing like a normal Android application? I imagine there must be like some differences, right? Like you must have some considerations that you think about versus just developing a normal Android application.
Yeah, that's, of course, the consumer is different, right? The user in the Fabric case is a developer. So what you want to do is create an easy-to-use API, a natural API. And when you are doing app development, you should care about APIs, but you maybe don't care. And that's okay if your coworkers are happy about it. So that's the main difference, right? When you're doing app development, you just have to ship a shiny thing for the consumer. And in the case of SDKs, your consumer is the developer, so you better do a rock-solid SDK with a really good API.
Now, when you are developing for developers and you have an external API, I know that any change or any new API that you develop probably goes through a lot of churn internally, right? Because you have to decide if this is something that you want to support for the next couple of years. Is that something that you found to be the true?
Yeah, definitely. When we ship something, we know that it's going to be there for at least, you know, a year. And we cannot deprecate it and just forget about it. You have to support it, right? So you better get that right. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be right. Otherwise, you're going to have a pain for a long time.
So, Israel, some time back, you gave this amazing talk called Android Development Like a Pro. And in that, you talked about like many good practices, and you had this very specific term, which I like. It's an acronym called DRAF.
Yeah.
Deliver really awesome features fast, right? And some of the techniques you can use to achieve that sort of flow and that process. So we thought it'll be cool to chat with you about that talk and some of like the points you brought up, because, yeah, it was a super interesting one.
Actually, I don't know how that come, DRAF. I was looking for something cool to start the talk. And I was saying, you know, with my broken English, of course, for deliver really awesome feature fast. I thought that should be fun. Let's see if there is like a war with that. And there was one. So it was pretty good.
So speaking of talking about developing as, you know, an Android professional, I know that you probably love, like everybody else, to talk about fragments. What would you say some of the problems with fragments are? Because I know I've seen some of your tweets recently, and you've even, I don't know if you coined the term, but I guess you probably have, called the burrito design pattern. If you could talk about that, and maybe some of your experience with Fragments would be great.
Pending.
Yeah, trademark, yeah. Yeah, with Fragments. So the thing is, you know, at the end, as engineers, we have to decide, right? We have to balance a bunch of stuff, you know, the pros and the cons, and figure out if that's a good balance for us. And in the Fragments case, you know, the life cycle is so complex, and another thing that, you know, the burrito design pattern, which was just an excuse to drop their GIF from Adventure Time, you know? But the idea, I think the idea is pretty good. Like, the burrito design pattern, what happens with a burrito? Burritos are awesome, but mm-hmm. it happens to me a lot of time. I cannot eat cilantro. It tastes like soap for me. which by doing the talk, I realized that it's a DNA thing. So, like, a lot of Europeans have that issue, and I didn't know. So anyway, so I buy a burrito, and then I get cilantro on it, and it's like, oh, shoot, I'm not going to eat it because it's going to taste like soap. So yeah, they have to make another one for me, right? And that's the problem with Fragments. They couple everything. They couple the UI layer with the network layer, then with loaders. Everything is coupled to the context, and then so it's just too much, right? It's too much complexity added that doesn't help at all to testability and maintainability. So for you know, for a quick application that you want to ship in a weekend, then that might be fine.
Mm.
But if you're in a code base with millions of lines and 8 years old, in a team of 30 people, maybe it's not the best option. I think you can afford to do the same without needing Fragments. So I can actually just use the activity and inflate the custom views whenever I need them. Mm-hmm. And I can handle the navigation myself with a simple navigation manager, right? In the talk that I gave, I was giving an easy example. You just need a navigation manager and you have an URI. And each path on the URI could be one of the screens. So you always keep the stack of the view groups that you are showing.
Interesting.
So that's pretty much it, right? Because that was the idea of Fragments, was like controlling different parts of the screen. So you can reuse them for different screen sizes and all that stuff. But you can do that just yourself. I mean,
right.
What I was saying, it's about, you have to balance it. You are the one that has to decide if it's worth for you to handle everything manually or if it's not. So this was, the talk was intended for professional Android developers. So what I mean is somebody that works full time on an application and the application is meant to survive many, many years. So at that point, it's worth to invest on doing your custom navigation and maybe forget about Fragments. But yeah, sometimes, I mean, you need them.
It's interesting that you say that too, because I understand exactly where you're going with it. But I guess to be devil's advocate, and I come from the side of the fence where I consult for a lot of companies. And so when I come in, they want the best, you know, they want to be able to have something that's maintainable. They want to be able to hire for someone in the future. And so from my perspective, when I come in, I usually opt for Fragments just simply because at the end of the day, if they hire a developer after me, they can come in, they can see that it's Fragments and they can go off with it. And I didn't have to create a custom view thing. But I think if you do have a larger team and you find that works for you, I think it's a good option to go the custom view route. 'Cause I've tried it before and it does work nicely as long as you know what you're doing. So it's definitely two sides of the coin. And like you said, it's all about trade-offs.
Yeah. I mean, another thing that throws me back about Fragments is the life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
There is the life cycle that they show you in the documentation is just a piece of the real life cycle. And it depends on the activity life cycle. So it's like, okay, guys, can we make it more complicated, please? I just need more complication in my life. It's all good. I mean, you can understand how it works, but it feels like you have to be, you know, like a genius in order to be able to handle the many cases on those life cycles. So
somebody can probably get a PhD on just exploring, like, you know, they can make it their primary like thesis in their PhD to just explore the how they came up with the Fragment life cycle. It would be an interesting thing.
I've seen a lot of applications in my career for Android, and I have never, and with Fragments, and I've never seen two companies do it exactly the same. Sometimes people are handling stuff on Create, then it's on Activity Created, then it's on View Created, and there's just so many different ways to do it where all these little weird edge cases of bugs pop up that, unfortunately, as you guys have experienced it,
right,
you have no idea where the bug's coming from. It doesn't make sense. So you have to hop into the source code for the fragments. And then depending upon what version of Android you're running, the fragment manager may be doing something different and you're ready to pull your hair out at the end of the day. So that's the huge downfall about it.
Yeah. And at the end, they were trying to make something that worked for everybody. And my experience of making things generic for everybody is that they don't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's have different requirements, and I think that's the problem. But it's okay.
Now, earlier on, we were talking about in your talk, like how you had used custom views, and then you had mentioned an activity and a navigation manager. Can you walk us through what exactly that is for the listeners who are not familiar with that pattern or even those concepts?
Yeah. So, I mean, what you need in Android is just a context. With the context, you can get an inflator manager and then inflate views, right? So that's pretty much it. I just need a single activity that starts the application, and then I'm just going to wrap everything on my custom views and my custom classes. And I'm going to forget about the activity, except when the activity says, I'm going to be destroyed, right? That's pretty much the idea. Or you want to have access to on resume, on pause, and on destroy, pretty much. But otherwise, I'm just delegating the whole logic of inflating views to my custom business logic and my navigation manager. That was the idea that I have behind. Like, you can just get a context and do whatever you want.
So for those views, like, people are familiar with fragments, and you may have a screen that's where you're editing a username and a password or whatever. Now it has a couple of edit texts on it and some buttons or something like that, and maybe even add some items to the menu. And you say custom classes or custom views. Do you take all of that all those controls and whatever and widgets and shove them into like a master custom view that has all that same functionality into it? Or how do you normally go about, if I'm familiar with fragments, how do I get to the stage where I'm using custom views? Do you have any tips in regards to that?
Yeah, that's just what I do. I just get a master view of that one. And what I do then is use a layer architecture. So, I can separate concerns between different layers. So I just don't get all together on the, because the, we were talking about, I don't want all the business logic in the fragments. So let's not do the same with the views, right? Let's put in place a layered architecture that allows me to separate concerns. So the view is just going to be, updating the view, but then I will have the business logic in another type of class. That's pretty much the idea.
Okay.
So quick question, just following up on what Don asked. You mentioned that you have one custom view and in that you have different layers. So do you create like a real custom view? I mean, a whole custom view group along those lines, or do you just have like a frame layout as you would otherwise also have in a fragment, but have that in a custom fashion? And within that you have, again, independent custom views where you delegate the logic independently.
Yeah, so I will declare, the root view, which will be pretty much frame layouts, view steps, and things like that. And then I will be inflating them when I need them, right? Because you don't want to make the hierarchy that heavy.
Exactly.
That will be done through the presenter, right?
Right.
I'm just getting into the pattern now, but I have to think on those terms. Otherwise, people is going to be thinking, oh, so you put all of that in a custom view? And no, it's not. It's not in a custom view.
Let's actually dive into it, because we've talked about it on the show as well, like the presenter pattern, and you gave, even in your talk, you talked about it. So I think, let's dive in. So can you give us what your idea is about your version of the MVP?
Yeah, so model view presenter, right? That's the idea. That's the pattern that I apply to the applications that I work on.
Mm-hmm.
And it works pretty well with UI frameworks because the idea is to create three layers, and the view is going to be just in charge of updating the UI and notifying the user events to the presenter layer. And the presenter will be like a proxy, like a middleman. It will decide what is going to happen when that user event is triggered. And from there, the presenter will get the business logic, which is the model layer. And the model will return the data, and it will return in a way that the presenter is able to transform it to actions to the view, right? Like if I have to update the view with the user, imagine we are clicking a account settings and we go to the user settings, but we need that data form, right? So what is going to happen is when we click that button, the view is going to notify the presenter that we want to show that user screen. And then the user, the presenter will go to the model and say, can you give me the data for this user? And then that will be returned to the presenter. The presenter will transform that data POJO with data of the user into another entity that the view understand and allows the view to update itself.
So, you know, I got the model, the view, the presenter. I'm very familiar to it, but the question that I get asked when I go to conferences and people hear, you know, they hear you talking about MVP, they hear Kaushik, they hear myself, they hear all the other industry leaders talking about it. But the first thing they always ask is like, why do I do this at all? Isn't this just more abstraction? Isn't this just kind of more code? What are the big benefits that I get out of kind of adding all the ceremony?
Yeah, so the ceremony, all the template code that you have to add on the top of the code that you want to implement, allows you to increase the decoupling between the whole application. So, for example, if we want to update the UI, we don't really need to change anything on the presenter or in the model. We just need to change something on the view, right? So that allows us to be better at changing our behavior depending on the requirements. And then another thing that helps is that testability-wise is way better because you're going to be just testing the model for the business logic. And you don't have to care about views. You're not going to have to mock views and things like that. It's just going to be pure logic. It's going to be like a function, like input data, output data. So you just have to be sure that that function is doing what it's meant to be doing. Another thing that it's important when you work in a team with many, many people, it's consistency in the code base. I think it's a pretty common way of organizing teams here in the Valley to have feature teams. And the feature teams, they own a small piece of the whole code base. And what happens is you are working another feature team and then suddenly you have to modify another feature team code base and you enter there and it's like, okay, am I in the same application or is this another one? Because the code, depending on the feature team, is totally different. So it's better to have a plan. It's better to have a pattern that have none. So that's another good quality of having a pattern that it adds consistency into your code base. So pretty much testability and maintainability, and then increase the separation of concerns. Mm-hmm. Is exactly the opposite of the burrito pattern. You know, if the burrito was layer, they can just remove the cilantro from one of the layers and the other layers will be fine.
I love this analogy. This is an amazing analogy.
In the future, I will patent that burrito. You know, I will create like a Chipotle kind of shop and it will be like a layer burrito.
And you take the cilantro right out of the white rice, right?
The first advantage you spoke about is one that's not actually given enough prominence. And honestly, personally, the reason I got into doing this kind of presenter pattern was just that you mentioned that because the logic is decoupled, and when say a product manager or someone comes to you and says, hey, you know what, we really need this to change. And many a time, even the product managers, they're trying different things. And so they want to experiment with different features. Having to just change your presenter layer and change what's shown to the consumer is very beneficial in this way, because you can iterate really fast at the presenter layer. And like you mentioned rightly, the model layer is untouched. Everything else in your backend doesn't change. And so you're limiting the scope of change just to the place where the features are exposed, right? So that's a fantastic pattern. And I've actually found, yes, initially it takes some time to get used to this pattern and maybe it requires some setup time, but eventually I think it pays off in the long run.
Yeah, experimenting, it's a thing that I have to deal all the time. So now I'm working on Twitter for Android, by the way, and the experimentation part of it, there is a lot of experimentation, so
right.
Changes have to be made really fast, and definitely, you know, having a separation of concerns helps you. I'm not saying MVP is going to solve all your problems, because it's not. But it's really good for like a starting point. And then, of course, you can make an evolution from that. Yeah, and then, you know, for people that want to start on MVP, so in my talk, I actually created a repo with a sample project. And I have, you know, a bunch of branches with different patterns, with two different patterns.
Fantastic.
And they can check it out. I guess you will put that on the site. It's github.com/Riyadh/EffectiveAndroid.
Boom. Yeah, we'll definitely add a link to that in the show notes. And even if I didn't mention before, even to your talk, like the slides, you have some amazing, very pretty, beautiful slides with great content. We'll add a link to that as well in the show notes.
Cool. Thank you.
So now we talked a lot about kind of the MVP. We've talked about, you know, the layered approach, and there's so many articles out there. I mean, I can go read Martin Fowler. I can go read Uncle Bob. I can go read and all the new stuff that's come out. Do you have a preference on you know, architecture or any articles that you enjoy? Is it anything like, is it Martin Fowler? Is it Uncle Bob? Is it anything like that?
Yeah, so I definitely read them. I read Martin Fowler. I read Uncle Bob. And then another thing that I think it's fundamental for us is refactor code.
Mm-hmm.
So I read the Refactory Legacy Code book too.
Who was that by?
This is the Michael Feathers one.
Michael Feathers, I believe.
Working effectively with legacy code.
Yeah.
Yes. That is awesome book.
Yeah. So again, there is so many, many ideas out there, and I think you just have to test the one that it works for you. And none of them, so my experience is that none of them helps to everything. You just have to pick one and go with it. And then if it doesn't work, try another one. Like, for example, with this MVP, if you think about it, the model layer actually has two responsibilities.
Right.
It has the business logic, but then it has it gathers information from somewhere. Call it database or call it network layer, right?
The actual repository, right? Where you
right, the actual repository, which could be remote or could be local, right? Well, then we can improve it with the following Uncle Bob's clean architecture, which, by the way, that, you know, like a quick summary, it means that you have inner circles and the circles can only point inward. So pretty much getting the dependency and you will call the outer circle from inside. Pretty much that's the idea. So that translated to a way of translating to Android was, okay, let's create a layer that only has use cases. So it'll be like creating a class for one use case. And then, you know, I like that because then I have in a package all the use cases of the application. And when I have somebody coming on my team, I say, hey, why you don't check the use case package and you see what we do here in this application? So that's why I like that one. And it's super easy. It's just like a function. It's a function. You get an input and return output. So it's like, give me, you know, it will be like get user information by ID. So I'm getting an ID and I'm returning a user object. That's what Interactor is going to be doing. How is doing that? Well, probably asking to the new data layer, which is the repository, give me that information, and then it's going to transform that information into something that the BU understands. So that's the idea with the clean architecture, is that you now have one more layer, which is the domain layer, which is the use cases, and then you have the data layer, which is the repository, or where you get the data from, which it could be remote or locally from a database.
I like that distinction a lot, especially with model, because again, when you talk about models, it can mean like 100 different things. I like that you've broken it down into these things, like where it handles just your business logic and the other part is like your repository. In fact, even in your slides, you have something there, because always fundamentally the problem I've had, like I've read Uncle Bob's clean architecture pattern. I've read a whole bunch of the other patterns, and always because it wasn't designed specifically for Android, it's up to us for interpreting what would be the right way to adapt it for Android. And even in those, it's always very tricky. For example, with Uncle Bob's whole clean architecture thing, you mentioned the circles, and we'll add a link. I'll add actually a video talk in which he explains it in a good way, because just looking at the diagram is pretty confusing, because there's like gateways, controllers, presenters, interfaces, interactors, entities. I'm like, oh, Jesus, man, just give me something that works, like that isn't so complicated. But
it's too theoretic, right? It's not practical. So
exactly. A lot of it is like theory, and that makes it difficult, which is why having these sample repositories where someone actually demonstrates it makes it much more easier.
And another thing, you know, it's difficult for me to convince people about, hey, they ask me, you know, this actually clean code, I wasn't able to introduce that one in Twitter for Android Code. Mm-hmm. But because of that, right? Because they don't think, many people doesn't think that adding a new layer like the interactor is worth it, which, you know, which I understand because it's a lot of boilerplate. And depending how, it could even feel like over-engineered.
Absolutely. That's always a big problem. Like, I mean, even initially when I came up with this talk, I was like super gung-ho about this. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is how everyone should be doing it. But then I realized almost more than one person pointed out that it seemed like it was extremely heavy and it's hard to sort of understand it. So, and over-engineering can be like poison to the organization eventually, because everyone will start getting demotivated. And even to make changes, it might take more than like what should ideally take 5 or 10 minutes will start taking half an hour, 1 hour. And then that's basically how you kill your product.
Right.
But at some point, you know, if you have proper testing set up and you're writing those tests for those things, you'll notice that your regressions and anything of that nature kind of just drop immediately.
Right.
Like you stop creating extra bugs when before you would just make a quick change and introduce 5 other bugs on accident. So I think there's definitely all about trade-offs and you have to understand that. And some of it is education based for the organization, but I do agree if it's over-engineered, it can be a big detriment.
You know, what I realize is that a lot of people, you know, when I was starting doing unit tests, a lot of people in another organization, I'm not going to give names. they were telling, well, testing is complicated. Of course it's complicated. You are not born with that ability. You have to build it, right?
Yeah.
The same with development, right? So, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to do it. And then when you put them, when you show them the benefits, then they start realizing that it's important. But still, there is always somebody that's going to say, I mean, it's going to take me more time to add the test than writing this feature. And that's actually wrong. It's taking you more time because you don't code in a way that your dependencies are clear. And you're just making everything super coupled in one class. And that's gonna explode in a few weeks when nobody remembers anything about this class. So yeah, I think it's education. You get there. I don't want to test everything, but I want to test at least all my business logic. So I know that the requirements are working on my app.
Couldn't agree more. That makes so much sense. There's also this concept called a walking skeleton. And what I've found is if you put everything in place, for example, if you have in your Android app tests in place, at least some simple tests, and you have everything laid out, then it's a little easier to convince people because then they don't have to go through the trouble of actually trying to establish the frameworks and infrastructure. They can just like get in and start adding tests.
But with patterns, it's the same. Like at the beginning, it feels super complicated, but then you get used to that and it just works and you just understand. It's like a natural thing for you at that point. Yeah, at the beginning, it's difficult, but then it gets more natural.
And as your team starts to grow, you start understanding, you know, conversations between each other. You don't have to say, all right, well, remember, you know, this presenter or whatever. You can just kind of say, well, create this model and throw, you know, we're going to use MVP over there. And all of the team immediately knows what that means. You don't have to hop into the exact implementation details. So you can actually talk to your teammates using abstract terms once the team is up to date and can understand all the terms.
This was a lot of fun. But I guess at this point, we should move over to the awesome picks section for the week. And Israel, our esteemed guest, you can go first.
Okay, what a responsibility.
no pressure.
Yeah, so I mean, listen, this week I started with Dagger 2.
Oh,
at the beginning, okay. You know, it was tough. It was like, what are all these concepts coming from? Am I in another planet? But it's good. I have a problem with auto-generated code, and is that I want to understand how things work. And yeah, with this kind of auto-generated code, libraries is more complicated. But then, so I wasn't sure about the singleton annotation, you know. It says in the documentation, in a vague way, that it enforces a single instance. But I wasn't sure about it. So I decided to generate a demo project with and without the singleton annotation. And then I did a diff in both classes, auto-generated code by Dagger. in the company one. And yeah, I saw there was like a really nice scope provider. And that scope provider, I tweet about it, of course. In that scope provider, the scope provider is the one that enforces to have a unique instance for each scope. So if you annotate a dependency with Singleton or any kind of scope annotation, it's going to be unique for that scope. So that was, you know, that was an interesting thing, and I got, thanks to that, I started to understand how Dagger works internally. So I was really pleased with that find.
That is amazing, but I have to ask one question. I promise I'm not going to take us for another 30 minutes on this conversation, but I have to ask. This is something that I've also looked in the past. I'm really curious about it. The singletons in Dagger, they're not truly singletons, right? I mean, as in they're not actual singletons that we think about in the traditional aspect. It's just that they're singletons scoped to that specific graph, right? So like in Dagger 2, you have specific scopes. So essentially, it's just picking from like this map that it has internally. So whenever you ask for a dependency, it just picks the same thing. It isn't truly a singleton, right?
Exactly. It's not a traditional singleton implementation that we have in mind. It's what you said. It's if you go to a scope provider, you will see that they have like a map and they catch that. They have like get by, I don't remember what now, but they get, if the instance is already there, then it doesn't create another one. So that's pretty, yeah, that's what you said was right.
That's just, yeah, so amazing, especially when you understand how these things work.
Yeah, I was digging on the code base of Dagger 2, and I was like, whoa, what is this? Whoa, what is this? Whoa. And I was like, okay, you are so smart, guys. Really, really good.
Sweet.
Then for the music of the week, guys, I'm kind of obsessed with this artist called, I don't actually like modern music a lot for work. But this last month, it's been killer for me. It's called The Weeknd. And mm-hmm. I don't know. It just gives me a rush to the head. Like if I was in a continuous party, and it helps, and it helps me with code, which is really interesting. I never feel the same way. But usually I get classical music to get a deep focus. But you should check it out, The Weeknd. The last album is amazing. That's my music for this week. And then finally, so this is my favorite shortcut in IntelliJ is Command Shift A for Mac users. I'm really bad at memorizing shortcuts. So I just use this one, Command Shift A, and I'm able to find any action by name. So that speeds up everything. And the cool thing is that when you search that action, it tells you the shortcut on the right of the pop-up menu. So that helps me remembering those shortcuts too. So those are my picks for the week.
Perfect. I think those are killer.
Okay, I'll hop in next here. This is just kind of an announcement here, but if you're in Philadelphia in April, there is a conference called Philly Emerging Tech, also known as Philly ETE. I'll be speaking there, and I'll be talking about Realm. And you can, if you're going to be there, let me know, and we will grab a bite to eat or a coffee. The pick that I have that kind of impacted me this week was actually an essay by Paul Graham. And again, Paul Graham is one of the guys who started Y Combinator, and he has an essay about Life is Short. So this has nothing to do with mobile development, but it is basically a good essay to read to kind of get your mind framed correctly. It's talking about kind of essentialism and determining what is key in life and kind of cutting the BS. And he has one thing that he talks about in there where basically when folks talk to you online or kind of troll you online and kind of cut you down and you spend the time replying back and defending yourself, what you're actually doing by replying to them is actually just wasting your life. You only have a finite amount of hours on this planet. So, you know, use them wisely and seek out what matters to you. So it kind of relates very closely to a book I'm reading called Essentialism by Greg McCowan. Anyway, great little essay. Check it out. We'll have it in the show notes. And lastly, I recently just completed a series on Castor.io, which is a bite-sized Android training site that I have for UI testing and TDD with Espresso. So it's basically 7 videos where I talk about Espresso, custom matchers, TDD, red-green refactor, the whole gamut. So check it out if you're interested in testing or need some help understanding it. That's it for me.
Sweet. And I'll go next. So I have just 2 recommendations for this week. The first is something that I actually tried out at work. So I work at Instacart, and obviously the app is pretty big. One thing that I've found is the build times are a killer. Just imagine every time you make a change, you have to wait for at least a minute and 30 seconds or 2 minutes to see that change come up. And this can really slow your, it increases the feedback loop. And so essentially it takes a long time for development. And I mean, I think 2 minutes is crazy. Like 2 minutes is like crazy talk. Like in the web development world, it's like in seconds. So the fact that every time I have to change, I change one line in my Java class, it takes forever for that change to come up is crazy. Now, I know Android Studio has brought in Instant Run, and Instant Run is amazing. The problem is it's still in an alpha-ish stage, and so there are certain problems when you try to integrate it, especially with a complicated app that has many dependencies and third-party dependencies. So what I did, because I was getting really frustrated, I was trying to develop just one screen, and I realized what should take me like half an hour or 1 hour was taking me like 3 hours. So what I did is I tried to create a pared down version of the app. So usually when I'm developing just on a screen and I want to like quickly iterate through that screen alone, we talked a lot about presenters and all these things. Many a time, I don't really need a whole bunch of dependencies. I don't need to talk to an external library. I don't need a Dagger. I don't need any of these third-party dependencies that would otherwise take a long time. So what I did is I created a very pared down version of the app. So essentially just my model layer and one single activity. So this is like a completely independent application. And then the advantage is I can go crazy with all my dependencies. So I can go on the bleeding edge. I upgrade like the Gradle settings to be compatible with Instant Run. I could start development on my app, and every time I make a change, within seconds, I could see the change up on my emulator. Now, even without Instant Run, it was tremendously faster. But with Instant Run, it's like crazy fast, and it almost feels like web development. So if you're working in an organization that has this huge application, I would highly recommend it. Now, it took me some time to get that pared down version of the app running because obviously there are certain dependencies that might be linked, and it also depends on how your app is structured in the first place. If you're Israel or Don, then you would have been smart about it, used MVP and done things in a good way. So then it'll be even more easier. But I highly recommend this. This was a lifesaver. I spent half a day just trying to get the project up and running. And then some people thought I was crazy because I was at work and I was working on this thing that didn't seem even closely related to what I was doing. But the minute I got it up and running, I could finish my feature in like 1 hour. And then everyone was like, whoa, okay, so that is definitely something that makes sense. So I would suggest this. Just try it over the weekend and try to get this kind of a setup up and running.
Hey, you are not crazy. I do actually the same. That's how I'm able to be agile in a huge application that takes 5 minutes to compile. That's the only way.
I'll back up your comments as well.
So you tell me now.
Sorry. I should have sent an email to everybody in my team because they didn't know either. And when I told them, they were like, oh, this is genius. And it was like, I thought it was clear for everybody that we need to do that. Not really, really good, really good pick.
The other is, a good friend of mine, Matt Logan, who's also an amazing Android developer, he recently came up with this, I don't know if it's recent, but it's recent enough. There's this library called Pancakes, and we talked about this navigation manager, because one of the advantages with fragments is they take care of the backstack automatically for you, and so that's like a convenient thing. But essentially what he's done is for those of us who want to like switch to custom views and just have activities, he's written just that navigation part, and he's a big believer in tests, I know, so I'm very confident using this. So I highly recommend it. I'll add a link to the blog post where he introduces this library, but I think it's pretty cool. So those are my two picks.
Really good picks. I have a quick comment on how you say that, Don?
Essentialism,
sorry about that. I think it's super important to remember that we are here for just one shot. And another thing that I think is really important is whenever somebody tells you that that's impossible or crazy, they don't know. They are just trying to figure out like you, so just go with it.
Words of wisdom.
They are.
All right. I think that is an amazing stopping point for the show. Israel, if people... Okay, one last question. You go by many names. You go by Israel Federer, Israel Kamachi. I'm probably pronouncing all of these wrong. And then you have like Ralat. What's the story behind that?
So in Spain, we have two surnames. And it's really difficult for me in the US to make that understandable for the officials, the immigration officials, you know? And for companies too, like depending on the company, they pick one or another. So I think I'm in Twitter, they know me as Israel Camacho, but actually my real name is Israel Ferrer Camacho. So I have two surnames, right? It's not a middle name, it's two surnames. Oh. Because you pick, the first surname is for the father and the second surname is for the mother.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. That's amazing.
But I mean, you can call me Ralat because I've been using that nickname even before Twitter. I joined Twitter in 2008 as a user. So yeah, Ralat is fine. Not really worried.
So if you have a child, how does that work out for you and your wife? If you have two surnames and she has two surnames, how does that work out?
So it picks the first of each parent.
Oh.
Yeah, that's how it works. Yeah.
Interesting. Learn something new today on Fragmented Podcast.
This is what we do.
That's right. Educating people worldwide. Globalization.
Perfect. And so if people want to reach you on Twitter, that's at Ralat. So R-A-L-L-A-T.
Exactly. Yeah.
Perfect. Don, how do we reach you?
You can reach me at Twitter at Don Felker. That's with two N's. Same for my website, donfelker.com.
Perfect. And I'm Kaushik Gopal on Twitter, and my site is kaush.co. Thank you, folks, for listening, and we will catch you next week.